Judge Reyes, Judge Hooton, Judge Cochran, the Honorable Peter M. Reyes, Jr. presiding.
Good morning, counsel. You may be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is Tuesday, February 19th, 2019. We have six cases on our calendar for today, five of which are set for oral argument. This is the third of five cases on our oral calendar. It is A18-0860, Olympia Cedillo et al. Versus Herbert Igbanugo. I knew how to say it before. I've forgotten. Igbanugo.
Yes, sir.
Correct. Okay, thank you. Et al. Counsel for appellant, you will have 15 minutes for your initial arguments, followed by 15 minutes by respondent, and then 5 minutes for rebuttal if you so choose. When you approach the podium, please state your name for the record and the party you're representing. And with that, counsel, you may proceed.
May it please the court, thank you for the opportunity. If I say that this case being here this morning is being in the twilight zone, it's an understatement. The jury verdict in this case is manifestly and palpably contrary to the evidence, even when viewed in light most favorable to the verdict. There's no documentary evidence whatsoever that supports the contention here, other than testimony, perjured testimony, uncorroborated testimony, testimony that is contradicted by deposition statements of this movement. On my side, I have documentary evidence. I have records of when I meet with clients, who I meet with, who was present. I have a statement called a disclaimer in my fee agreement, bold capital letters. I've done better now. I have a signature line under it now. That is explained to these clients, no guarantees whatsoever. It's a cultural thing. I see clients all the time come in my office and they always say, how long, how much time? And it's understandable that they want to understand, but no one. You have to get to be a dumb idiot and a fool to guarantee somebody immigration results within a specific time. I've done this for 31 years.
Well, I think it seems like the primary claim is, though, and as testified to by the expert, is that there were two forms that you had agreed that you would pursue filling out and submitting, and that you advised them that they would be able to, because of the American citizenship of the daughters or the children, that you'd be able to get them a green card based on that, which the expert testified was not the law.
Well, first of all,
that's the primary issue.
First of all, that's not true. What do they have to have to support that I said that? First, I have to be incompetent or not know what I'm doing. What that's about, Your Honor, is really the constant changes in immigration laws. Immigration law is a moving goalpost. A client comes to me today, they have certain relational and personal circumstances. Two of the three clients came to me and said, well, I have a fiancé, I have a boyfriend that I'm going to marry, a U.S. citizen. I said, okay, in two cases, that's good. We have something here. And most of the time, when they say they're going to marry, they marry. Once in a while, they don't. Things change. So I take in a client. I say, okay, I'm going to be able to do a U visa for you. I'm going to be able to do an I-130 because you have a possibility of marrying. Now, the law is about to change. Everybody believes that Obama now brings in DAPA, says, okay, we're going to change the qualifying relatives for these immigration benefits. And the laws change all the time. I cited in my cases the number of times the immigration laws have changed in 10 years only. And President Trump might wake up tomorrow and say, okay, the DACA cases, you're in. I have DACA clients that have been my clients for 2-3 years, and they're just maintaining. And we're trying to do very different things, make maneuvers. But to say that I told them that they're qualified presently, for the relief sought is patently false. There's no evidence whatsoever to support that other than their testimony. None.
I mean, I just want to clarify what the issues are. So you're denying that you ever told them anything about these two forms?
First of all, it's not just even forms.
Are that you were going to
categorically
get them a green card based on their children's American citizenship?
Categorically, in my children's lives. First of all, I say categorically. What I said is that the law is about to change. Everybody believes the law is going to change.
That's what I wanted to. So you were anticipating the law would change.
Exactly.
But it did not change.
Exactly. And the clients understood.
Just to clarify, then you don't dispute respondents' statement that on page 6 of their brief that respondents were never eligible for a provisional waiver.
They were never eligible for a provisional waiver. First of all, there's two reasons why I believe they were eligible. One is that they were going to marry U.S. citizens, two of them.
Two of the three.
Two of the three. They had boyfriends. The record reflects that. They had boyfriends. If they married their boyfriends, those boyfriends would have been qualifying relatives for the waivers. On the other hand, sometimes this is about giving somebody hope. Hope to live another day and see if things change. I said everyone believes there will be changes. Obama is trying to do this, striving, you know, some state governors filed a lawsuit and prevented that. Eventually, it didn't come to pass. But everyone believed it would. So I said, in anticipation of that, let's get things ready, just in case. That's how everyone might know practices immigration law. You have to anticipate changes in the immigration laws.
Right, but don't you also have to look at the immigration laws that are in place at that time?
Yes. I did look at the immigration laws that are in place at that time. But no one can practice immigration law competently without anticipating that there might be changes. Because, for instance, if you have an 18-year-old kid or a 19-year-old kid, that kid cannot file a petition for you until they're 21. At their 20th birthday, you start gathering documents and doing things. You can sign and you can actually sign on the client. And then, you know, when a person becomes 21, you file the petition instantly. But the retention agreements I had with them was that at least three of them on the second part were in anticipation of changes. Some people actually file an I-130 and close out the case and wait till their children grow up or something else happens or there's a change. It happens all the time. This law firm uses it. And I cited something on the record showing where, in fact, one of the principals in the firm has said, just a case that came to me off the cuff, that said, you haven't approved that 130. That's one step of the process, and you can close your file or wait till there's a change in the law. Everyone believes there's going to be a change in the law. There has to be a comprehensive immigration reform in this country. The immigration process cannot keep going the way it is. So anyone who's in the country at this point has some hope of proceeding, okay? But the way, and it wasn't just one form. When I take on an immigration client, I look at a full panoply of things that are possible now and possible in the future, and things that will help them if they are arrested by the immigration. The I-130 that's called worthless by this firm is something that if you actually have it approved, if the immigration arrests you, you say, I have an I-130 and I approve the I-130. That alone is enough to get you released from custody because you're trying to do things the right way. It's always been a benefit in removal proceedings. I've done this for 31 years, served over 20,000 clients. Not once in that 30 years have I been sued for malpractice, fraud, negligence. I've had 84 federal cases in federal courts. I know immigration law.
Okay, can I ask you this? Because, I mean, you're making some very eloquent arguments here today, and I assume you made those arguments before the jury. And we're only a reviewing and error-correcting court. How do we, we have to view this in the light most favorable to the jury's verdict. How do we overcome, in reviewing this case, that very high burden you have here?
First, I didn't make those arguments to the jury because I wasn't allowed to represent myself. 4 weeks before the trial.
Were those arguments made on your behalf, though, to the jury?
No, because the lawyer I hired 14 4 weeks before the trial, had to catch up after opposing counsel had opposed our representation for some 8 months, a year before then. The judge never did anything. At the last minute, he threw us out, me and my opposing, my partner here. And even if I was to testify, there's nothing I could testify he couldn't testify to. That's one of the things I objected to. It was unfair, because I feel like I had my back, my hands tied behind my back, and I had to sit and take it, and take the...
Counsel, according to the briefing, there was at least one meeting where your co-counsel was not present, that you were present at, and so your testimony was required.
Okay, I agree to that. Okay, so throw me out. What about him? There was no reason for him to have been tossed out of that case whatsoever.
I'm sorry, did he fully answer your question, Judge Hooten? Okay. I'd like to turn to one of the legal issues, your argument about the Consumer Fraud Act, your separation of powers argument. Under your view, the Consumer Fraud Act does not apply to attorneys under separation of powers. So what remedy, if any, would a client have against an attorney who commits fraud?
The OLPR, the Office of Lawyers Professional Responsibility, Conciliation Court, litigation without...
How would claiming. Conciliation court work?
Well, this was a total of $25,000 altogether. That's the amount at risk. For each client, it was under $10,000. Conciliation court has a maximum of $15,000. It's not the first time anybody's ever gone to conciliation court and said, give me back some money.
But what would the claim be then?
The claim would be that you didn't do the work. Like, it's people's court. You tell the judge, clients do it all the time. You go to conciliation court, you file a claim saying, I want my money refunded because you didn't do what you told me. And the judge will look at it and decide whether you've earned this or you've earned that. This action was only brought the way it was because of personal animus against me by the Wilson Law Group. But that's not even relevant at this point. I won't bring that up.
So, from a policy perspective, if we accept your argument, is it your position then that the legislature couldn't impose criminal penalties on attorneys for deceit or collusion? Currently under Minnesota law, there's a statute, 481.07, that imposes, provides that it's a misdemeanor for an attorney to commit deceit or collusion in an action or judicial proceeding. Is it your position that law would violate the separation of powers as well?
Not necessarily, because that would be a criminal proceeding in criminal court. Nobody's above law if it's a misdemeanor. You said, if I understood you correctly.
Well, but both statutes go to, or both cases would go to the attorney's conduct. And so I guess I'm having trouble distinguishing why that statute would not violate the separation of powers, but application of the Consumer Fraud Act would.
Your Honor, if I understand correctly, the statute you're mentioning now pertains to saying that it's a misdemeanor for an attorney to be deceptive or to lie. Yes, I mean, that wouldn't, because it's a general clip. That pertains to criminal activity. Anyone could be subject to criminal prosecution regardless of your profession.
Well, that statute specifically applies to attorneys. It was referenced in respondent's brief. It's 481.07.
Okay, but it does not apply to apply, my argument is essentially that it's the judicial province. There's separation of powers, there's a legislature, there are certain things they can do. Maybe the statute is out of place, I don't know. It's not for me to decide, but I think that to apply it in the way it was applied in this case does not make a lot of sense. There's no legal backing for it. The Honorable Judge Dickstein cited to a Walserford salesman case and another case that pertains to insurance from another state to justify that there's...
But private parties can use the Consumer Fraud Act, correct? They can bring claims.
Yes, I believe they could. And I'm not even worried about a consumer fraud case. Look at the merits of the case. The theory of recovery here is that I try to steal money from these folks $25,000. When in my career I've made millions, I represent corporations and all kinds of things.
So just to be clear, your position is not that the Consumer Fraud Act cannot apply in cases involving disputes between attorneys and clients. Is your argument that it's not applicable in this case?
Well, that's what I've argued, that it's not really applicable because it's my opposition.
Not applicable in this case?
It's not applicable because it's something that belongs to the justice sector, just because of the unique nature of legal services.
So are you saying that the Consumer Fraud Act was wrongly enacted because it, on its face, it violates the separation of powers?
I'm not that bold to say that. But I think it is not applicable with respect to their to lawyers, especially when there's other remedies and the Office of Lawyers' Professional Responsibility and the Supreme Court are charged.
Well, what other remedies? I mean, if you have, you know, let's just say hypothetically, you have an attorney that's misrepresented and committed a fraud against, you know, clients, and they've sustained damages. How are they going to recover those damages?
Breach of contract.
You keep bringing up the lawyer's professional board.
Breach
they
of
don't
contract.
Award damages, right?
There's breach of contract. There's port. There's all sorts of other theories that could have been brought up. The only reason why the Consumer Fraud Act was brought into this case is so they can get attorney's fees. That's it. That's it. That's a stretch. And that's why Judge Dickstein denied that. Now, come to consumer fraud. You have to prove your fact. You can't just say only three testimonies. There was all this convoluted about this person interpreted, and this person said this to this person, and that person said that to that person. I don't know all that. But to say that I intentionally tried to steal money, $25,000 from these folks, after a 30-year career where I have fought vehemently for clients. People owe me $2 million out there. I've never denied a client for not paying me fees. It hurts my soul. I was brought up right. I'm a Christian. I know right and wrong. That I stole money? It's impossible. I'm an anti-corruption lawyer in my former life. Not former life. Other life.
And counsel, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you.
You've already exceeded your time. Thank you, counsel.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Michael Gavigan on behalf of respondents and cross appellants. I intend to focus my attention today on three interrelated and perhaps the most complex issues before the Court. As the Court's already inquired about the general applicability of the Consumer Fraud Act or the CFA to attorney conduct, injunctive relief that's available under the CFA, and attorney fee availability under the CFA. The standard for the Court in determining what the CFA applies to incorporates definitions that are in place in Minnesota Statute 325F.68. That definition set in there includes a definition of a person that specifically includes a legal representative in that definition. Now, the appellants have a misplaced reliance on the separation of powers doctrine. This case is not about whether Mr. Igbanego or the firm may practice law before the courts. The entirety of the authority cited in their briefing materials focuses on that issue. They were decided on that issue. The Clerk of Courts Compensation for Lyon County case cited in the materials confirms that a court has inherent authority to control issues of judicial self-preservation, what is inherently necessary to a court's functions in order for it to survive and work. As it applied in the Shrewd v. Hatfield case, that meant who is able to apply for and become an attorney licensed to practice law before the courts. The statute at issue in that case pertained to the regulation by the legislature of professional entrance exams into the industry. That's not at issue here. We're not talking about whether Mr. Igbanogho can practice. Similar for the Nicolette Restoration and Turnham matter, in which the issue was appearance by non-attorneys for corporate entities in the context of a conciliation court appeal. Again, that goes to the district court. The district court gets to decide who appears before it. That's not at issue here. The decision in that matter even said specifically that the court recognizes the legislature's ability to decide who gets punished for conduct, just not who gets to practice law in the court.
Counsel, the rules of professional conduct govern conduct by attorneys, correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
And I believe there's one rule that prohibits fraud by attorneys.
Yes, I guess
8.31.
Accuracy in communications is generally a component of the rules. It appears in multiple places. I believe the citation from the court is specifically for misconduct.
Correct. I guess my question is, I understand the need for a client to have a remedy and that the Consumer Fraud Act might provide that remedy in terms of damages, but to the extent you're seeking an injunction, why is that not regulating the conduct of an attorney and the manner in which an attorney practices law? Why would that not be within the purview of the courts rather than the legislature?
Multiple points in response, Your Honor. First, to some extent it may be. There is no prohibition on multiple avenues seeking to restrain or deter conduct that is not warranted for public policy reasons, legislative reasons, whatever that it may be. Beyond that, the statute in the Consumer Fraud Act at 325F.70 regarding the availability of an injunction, it specifically says it shall be no defense that the state may have adequate remedies at law. And there's no argument being made that the OLPR is anything other than a state actor. It's established by the Supreme Court. It's an entity and arm of the state. And specifically, the legislature says whatever else is available doesn't matter. Beyond that, there are different policy goals and purposes of the two different functions. So the OLPR, while its goals and its obligations are, you know, admirable and necessary and very appropriate, it doesn't have the same scope. So it addresses a narrow set of disciplinary conduct, whereas the CFA, as reflected both in the notes during its passage when it was being debated and has been upheld routinely in the case law such as Levy-Nystrom, specifies that it has an extraordinarily broad application and goal to protect a broad range of consumers and to actually make it easier to prosecute people for deceptive conduct in business practices and solicitation. That is not present in the OLPR. Beyond that, there's a different burden of proof that goes to different actions. In the OLPR, there's prosecution. I'm sorry, Your Honor, I believe you had a question.
Well, I just want to follow up because I think Judge Cochran had asked you about the denial of attorney's fees under the Act. And if the judge found that the denial was appropriate because you did not sufficiently show that this was for the general good of the public. My question is, what's our standard of review relative to that determination?
Sure, Your Honor, the standard of review in this matter is de novo. It's a matter of statutory interpretation and determining how that law applies. And our argument here, and I think it's borne out by the relevant case law, is that the court made plain error because it considered things outside of what the applicable analysis is. So normally, as the court's familiar with, when considering injunctive relief, the court goes through the Dahlberg factors, which are a multifaceted and varied set of elements that include all sorts of equitable issues and facts and circumstances in the case. That's not at issue here. The relevant standard here, as established, is essentially were the prerequisites for the remedy demonstrated? And the court found that they were, because there was a violation, as the jury found, of the CFA's provisions. And two, would the injunction fulfill the legislative purposes of the statute? Nowhere in the analysis is there a requirement that the court look to whether appropriate oversight exists elsewhere. It's just not part of the standard that the court has to apply. Additionally, beyond that, as to whether the injunction would fulfill the legislative purposes of the statute, I find it difficult to believe that there's a meritorious argument that you can have a pattern of three nearly identical factual circumstances that the jury finds violates this specific provision, and that we're asking to restrain that same type of conduct going forward, that doesn't fulfill those purposes.
But whether to grant an injunction or not by this by the district court, wasn't that a discretionary call?
Not if they misapplied the standard, and if there's no serious contention to be made that restraining the types of conduct that was already found to be violative in the future would not be within the purpose of that statute that was already found to be violated.
But again, the court has to weigh the equities, and there's already been a substantial award, a damage award, given to your clients. And if the court balanced that award with the equities, the benefits of an injunction, and decided that injunctive relief wasn't appropriate under the facts of this case, how can we as a district court find that that was a clear abuse of discretion?
Again, Your Honor, they misapplied the correct standard. The State Exwell Hatch v. Cross County Bank case specifies that if those two single elements are met, the issuance of an injunction is required. If we want to talk about equities, we can talk about what that injunction would look like and how it should be formed, but that's not before the court.
Is there any evidence that anyone other than these three individuals had a similar experience in terms of, as you allege, that they were told that they would get a green card based on their adult children's status?
In the record, there would not be evidence that there are additional persons who have been subjected to the same treatment. What the record does show...
Does that support the district court's determination, then, as to whether there's really a public benefit or a public purpose here?
Sure. Going back to the public benefit, which is only relevant to the extent that we're making a determination on the attorney's fees issue, yes, that is a relevant issue to consider, whether or not there's a public benefit. I would characterize the record as saying there are...
Doesn't it also go to the whether there's a need for an injunction in terms of the purpose of the injunction?
Yes, Your Honor.
Sorry, I maybe misspoke earlier and kind of confusing the two, but I guess what I was trying to say is, if you're not bringing this for a bubble, if there wasn't a public benefit purpose, the court didn't find a public benefit purpose in bringing the action, doesn't that support the court's conclusion that there isn't a need for an injunction?
It does, and there's two reasons why that doesn't apply here. So one would be the evidence presented before the court is irrefutable that there were three client circumstances that were presented in the evidence. Of those three circumstances, the appellants engaged in this practice every single time. They would have had an opportunity, should they so choose, to show that this was simple error by indicating that there were other people that they didn't make these promises to and didn't make these assurances
to. But I think it sounds like you're getting into hypothetical, though, in terms of what happened with other people. And the fact of the matter is you've got three clients here where the allegations were that they basically money was taken from them and services weren't provided, or the services that were provided weren't appropriate. But that's all we have are three particular instances, and injunctions, usually you have those when you want to prevent ongoing activity of some kind and evidence that there's ongoing activity. What in the record do we have that beyond just these three? It seems like I'm having a hard time understanding where the district court erred or abused its discretion by saying there's no need for an injunction. We've got the three particular cases here. They've been resolved. It's over and done with. There isn't anything more to do.
And that's a misapplication of law because the requirements for the standard set in Levy-Nystrom say there may be circumstances, indeed, where injunctive relief or the attorney fee award may not be appropriate. And those are specifically identified as a single one-on-one transaction that's incapable of repetition. That's not what we have here.
Why isn't that the case here? Because there, it's incapable of repetition unless he were going to go out and try to resign those clients up again. It's incapable of repetition.
That's not correct, because no one is arguing that there aren't individuals out there that are in the same circumstances.
But we
that's
don't have a
relevant
situation where there was an advertisement to the public, or, you know, there. Help me identify any specific facts in the record that would show that this would is likely to happen again.
Well, I don't think that there needs to be a showing that there's a certain percentage or a certain likelihood. The CFA is designed so that when there is a violation, the claimant who proves a violation is entitled to injunctive relief going forward to restrain that type of conduct in the future. That is the express goal and purpose of the CFA.
All right, I'm going to go back to the Hatch case, and it says the injunction would fulfill the legislative purposes behind the statute's enactment. Doesn't that phrase give the court the discretion to decide if for the purposes of this statute, these, your clients, have been fully satisfied and that an injunction is not necessary?
The legislative purpose of the statute is to deter wrongful conduct on the part of a business practicing and soliciting consumer money.
But if damages are determined to be sufficient to deter that, I mean, isn't that a discretionary call?
Again,
if it can be made by the judge?
But if the deterrent effect is sufficient in the monetary damages, that's because there was a violation of the law. And that's the only thing that's required for this to then trigger the analysis on the injunction. So that probably wasn't terribly clear. But so whether a violation occurs is essentially the prerequisites, the first part of that analysis. If that violation is in any way capable of repetition, then injunctive relief is warranted. That's the primary relief available under the Consumer Fraud Act. To say that there may be equitable circumstances that say we don't have as much to be concerned about here, whether this will happen again, is not something to consider within the CFA. It says a violation occurred, we need to make sure this doesn't happen again. That's what this purpose is. Going beyond that, we look to cases that show you can't focus on the number of people that were affected or the number of people that may be affected in the future. That's the Collins case. The Collins case specifically says it's not important how many people were affected, and the Court of Appeals was overturned by the Supreme Court for focusing on that as an issue. Instead, what's more important, because choosing a number would be arbitrary, any place we would choose a number.
But here, I mean, in this record, and you're citing Collins in support of your position, but in Collins, the School of Business in that case, the defendant, offered its programs to the general public and aired commercials on TV advertising the program, and that was, and it was the information contained in that and those commercials and its general offering to the public that were found to be fraudulent. And so, I mean, we don't have any evidence in this record of that, do we? I mean, other than these three people, is there anything in this record that indicates that there was any other attempt our solicitation under the same circumstances?
And I see that my time is out. May I respond to the court's inquiry?
You may.
So in response to that, I would say, again, there's a few things to focus on here. So one is we have the evidence before the court is singular in its clarification that of the three people that have been exposed to this, all three of them were presented with the same information. That establishes that there was an ongoing practice there. I would understand if this was a single isolated incident that said, oh, this is an error, our mistake. That's not what happened here. What happened is every single time someone presented with these factual circumstances in the record, the deceptive practice occurred. That warrants preventing it from going on in the future. Specifically, I would also encourage the court to consider a variation on Judge Simonette's dissent in the Church of the Nativity of Our Lord, where the dissent had encouraged a four-factor test to determine whether there is, in fact, a public benefit here. And that analysis essentially goes to the heart of what you just asked, Judge Hooten, which is, how do we know whether this sort of thing needs to be deterred? And the analysis
was... But that was a dissent, though. And that was not
that was adopted. A dissent. Okay. And that was eventually incorporated, not specifically as a rule in Levy-Nystrom, but that essential justification or the rationale for the Lee decision is largely derived
right,
from there.
Right, but that specific test was not adopted. In
That's correct, Your Honor. There has not been an articulated, precise test for how this applies.
Anything else to briefly to respond to Judge Hooten's question?
The only thing I would indicate is that the what should be at issue here is, was there a general business practice or pattern? That should be the applicable analysis. If you have a general practice or a pattern established, it's likely to continue in the future.
And is that a factual issue?
I would say that's not a factual issue here, because again, the only evidence in the record is that for every instance where this came up, he did it.
But that's evidence in the record. That's a factual issue then.
Right, but that fact only cuts one way. That fact set is not up for appeal. It's not being contested. The jury found what it found, and it found in it can only be interpreted one way.
Wrap up.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you, Counsel.
Talking about the jury had no prayer in this case. They didn't understand the immigration laws. It's very complex, and I'm not making it up. I think I cited in my brief a notable jurist once lamented that the immigration laws and the tax codes were designed by Congress to accelerate the aging process of judges. The jury did not understand what the intricacies of this case. Even Judge Dixon, I even don't believe understood it quite well, because if he did, he would have missed one of the evidentiary rulings he made. In the long run, they say I told these clients these things. I didn't tell them. I mean, what am I supposed to do? Tattoo on their clients' heads, I have told you that I can't guarantee you a result. And what would cause a person of my age, caliber, religious belief, and pedigree to lie to three poor innocent human beings? I tell you what it is. It's the Wilson Law Firm. That's what happened. Nelson met them.
And you're making what I would think are very good arguments that could have or should have been made to the jury. But we're reviewing court, so we cannot retry the case.
Okay, but what?
And to the extent the jury believed the respondents over what your position, we have to defer to that as a reviewing court.
Not necessarily. Otherwise, I mean, this is the jury verdict cannot be sustained on any reasonable theory of the evidence. The jury could not reasonably believe what they believed because there's no evidence to support it. There's nothing on this record. The jury says we met with him with our kids on three or four occasions. I provide a record that says I met with him once or twice with this date and time and who was there. They go in there. Some of the arguments being made here now that I guaranteed them 100% result was not even in the complaint. It was not in any other way other than their testimony. And in the deposition testimony, how did I meet these three? I did immigration work for their family members. I got green cards for their family members, several of them, until they met Wilson, and Wilson says, you can get some money, and appealed to their, you know, as normal human beings, they agreed. This is a personal matter. It's between me and Wilson. He's just using these good folks. For this particular purpose, I walk up and I tell a client that I guarantee you a green card in 6 months, I should be committed. No, it's impossible for the jury to believe that any reasonable attorney would do that. There's no evidence other than their words put in their mouths by a Western law group. That's what it is. I'm here fighting for my life, my reputation of 31 years. You know, I mean, I'm flabbergasted by what's happening here. I just cannot understand how somebody can throw some things together, have it come through three innocent, calm, nice Hispanic clients, and every record I have in my system, the documents, my fee agreement, all that's out the window.
Okay, but are you saying that there's absolutely nothing in this record that supports what the respondents are claiming here today?
Yes, categorically, nothing. I would like to know.
Because if that were true, it should have never gone to the jury in the first place.
That's why I said the judge made a mistake. I filed a motion to dismiss with sanctions, that they should be sanctioned for not investigating the case.
But if we look at the record and we see evidence that they testified that you told them that this was a method by which they could get a green card, and they understood that that was the law, what you advised them. I mean, if that testimony is in there and the jury believed them, how can we, as an error-correcting court and a reviewing court, find otherwise? Otherwise, we're just balancing the testimony and credibility and everything else.
Your Honor, what you're saying is that if, because the jury says 1 + 1 = 3, a reviewing court can't correct them and say 1 + 1 = 2. It makes no sense.
Because true. That's a fair statement. But I think what Judge Hooten is saying is, if it's a battle of credibility and who he said versus she said, and there's evidence in the record that you testified as to explain to them X, Y, Z, but they say, no, he told us A, B, C, we on review can't change that. As long as there's evidence in the record to support the jury's verdict, that's
reasonable.
Really the key
the correct term, I believe, is that the respondents, well, the jury verdict is manifestly and palpably contrary to the evidence, even when viewed in light most favorable to the verdict. The jury verdict cannot be sustained on any reasonable theory of evidence. In this case, they said there were meetings where I told them all these lies. But I have documentary evidence that shows I never met with them alone. I met with them always with a staff member that could speak Spanish. That's the documentary evidence. So because Wilson Law Group tells them to say what they said, you have to believe them. There's no evidence, no record evidence at all.
Right, but didn't they testify before the jury that of what their recollection of what was said at the meetings? And isn't that, and doesn't that support the jury verdict? What they testified to, what they
if
said.
If it was just hearsay, and I know that there's a big difference for the jury, if it's just they said, I said, I get where you're going. But if they said, I said, and the documentary evidence shows that the meetings they claim happened never even happened, because I wasn't with them and their daughters, and it's their daughters speaking Spanish to them as to what I supposedly said, which we call double hearsay,
that's a separate issue, though, in terms of the whole double hearsay with translation, though.
But I cannot imagine a legal world where, because a jury says something just by virtue of saying it, and the jury believes them, that's the end of the case. That's why there's a standard that if no reasonable person can differ, that there's nothing to sustain this amount, that type of claim, I mean, you still, it could be reversed. There's a standard for reversing a jury verdict, and there's a standard for reversing a judge that refuses to reverse a jury verdict. That culminates in this case. I just beg this court, because what's at stake for me here is not just money, it's my professional reputation, 32 years. They didn't have to charge consumer fraud. They could have charged any other thing. The only reason for the consumer fraud is money, the fees, $82,000 that he's desperately arguing for here. This is a sin and a shame. That's what this case is, and I tell this court from the bottom of my heart that this is a travesty of justice. I don't belong here. under the circumstances. I have not done anything to earn it. 32 years I've labored in my life. Over 20,000 clients. Not once has anybody ever brought this type of case. And it's Wilson Law Group, Wilson that worked for me, I trained. I'm very sorry about my tone, but this is personal to me. Thank you.
Thank you both, counsel. It was very well argued, and we appreciate that. We'll be issuing an opinion within the 90-day statutory time. Thank you both. Thank you all, I should say.